News Journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco for July 7, 2005. A press conference in Washington County today provided more fuel for speculation than it did answers about the secretive process being used to push approval of a liquefied natural gas facility on Passamaquoddy tribal land. We'll get reaction from Madonna Soctoma, former Passamaquoddy representative. And we'll talk with Lynn Williams, an attorney who represents members of the Passamaquoddy tribe opposed to the LNG plant. But first, we're joined by John Hink, staff attorney for the Natural Resources Council of Maine. While George Bush is in Scotland telling the media that he and others at the G8 meetings are working to protect the environment, among other things, NRCM has been challenging the administration's policy on mercury emissions. Welcome, John Hink.
Hello, Amy.
Why are mercury emissions such a concern here in Maine?
People have probably heard before that we're sometimes called the tailpipe of the nation. The prevailing winds cross the entire country from the west and also even from the south and eventually reach Maine. And on those winds for quite a few years has been a fair amount of mercury, particularly released by coal-fired power plants that are upwind from the state of Maine.
I think that some of our listeners who are from the state are probably a lot more aware of this than listeners who this time of year may be visiting for the summer, and they don't put tailpipe of the country on the license plates or anything. So what are we talking about in terms of where it comes from and how dangerous it is?
Yes, on the first point, I do think that even though Maine seems to get a particularly large slug of mercury, it's deposited all across the country, so no matter where you come from, this should be a concern to you. Mercury is a potent neurotoxin, and we don't have much effect because of the small amounts that are in the air, but it builds up in the food chain, and we end up exposed because of food we eat, very specifically fish in particular, which can end up with very high concentrations of mercury. It's really problematic for young children, and therefore nursing mothers, women who are pregnant or may get pregnant should be very concerned about this, as should parents who have very small children, the ages of 1, 2, 3, up to 6, 7, 8.
And when you say potent neurotoxin, I know that it's been mentioned before, and you also are aware that the term Mad Hatter came from the process used in felting the people who are handling the old process for making felt and handling the mercury. To do that became exposed, had the neurological effects. So
mercury is devastating in so many ways on the nervous system. In the case of the old Mad Hatters that were the subject of the Alice in Wonderland character, they were apparently getting very large exposure from mercury used in felt. But you can find effects that are go throughout the nervous system of the human being at fairly low concentrations as well. It really interferes with development of the brain. Many of the cognitive problems that children sometimes have could be traced to or exacerbated by mercury in the system.
A lot of parents looking into the possibility that mercury may play a role in the development of autism, which is a very serious developmental disability.
That's true.
Among other things. So, obviously, mercury is a concern. Is it? You say it accumulates. Can you say a little bit more about that? It doesn't ever go away?
Yeah, unfortunately, mercury is an element, which basically means that it's permanent. I think that the Bush administration, which is taking a lax approach to mercury controls, wants people to believe, well, the emissions have been dropping, and therefore you should feel safe. The problem with that thinking is that actually mercury is cumulative in the environment, so we have a fair amount of all the mercury that's ever been deposited on the environment, and it's merely being added to by additional deposition of mercury from ongoing pollution sources. Now, that's not entirely clean like that, because mercury can go deep into the sediments and eventually become unavailable. But the fact is, it doesn't disappear or biodegrade. Instead, it concentrates in animals and fish.
It makes its way up the food chain.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned Bush. Can you say a little bit about the history of sort of the evolution and then, I guess, sort of de-evolution of mercury emission standards?
Well, it's long been a difficult issue because the sources are coal-fired power plants, and the industry is powerful. There are actually 1,100 old plants that burn coal and release quite a bit of mercury. Those plants need to be fitted with new scrubber technology. And if the best technology that's available today was used, their mercury emissions would drop by 90%. And that's where the rule was evolving as of the year 2000, when the current administration came in. Instead of requiring that each plant get the best available technology and put it into the stack and reduce mercury emissions 90%, the current EPA under the current administration has decided that they need to give more flexibility to the industry and has released a plan that is much more relaxed and allows much greater emissions of mercury.
So the original plan with the 90% actually would have only been requiring the coal-fired plants to use the best technology that's available today. That even that standard would not have required them to be looking into a process that, and maybe implementing over time a process that was even better. It would just require that they use what was existing.
That's right. It was in many respects already a compromise. It was very pragmatic. It's saying this is what we know can be done today. In the early days of aggressive environmental protection, we would sometimes use standards that would drive new technologies, and you'd set the goal beyond what was currently achievable, and that generally proved to work. We could have set the goal at 98% reduction or 95% reduction and assumed that fairly quickly new technologies could be developed to achieve that, but instead, pragmatically, the rule was set to reduce emissions 90%. And the EPA decided that was too much. We needed to relax it from them.
Which puts the NRCM sort of in one of those strange bedfellows kinds of situations where you have both of the state's Republican senators speaking out against the EPA, saying the Environmental Protection Agency isn't being strict enough in setting the standards. But rather than, and both of those senators, both of our senators have signed on to a petition that may or may not have any impact, but NRCM is taking another step, which is to launch legal challenges. Can you say a little bit about what that process is?
Sure. You gave me the opportunity to comment on the senators. I do think that they are showing leadership on this issue, and even though generally speaking, their voting record is for fiscal conservative approach and their understanding of business interests, they do believe that you have to protect the environment in the end. And for that, I think they deserve a lot of credit, and they are willing in some instances to stand up and say that, you know, this needs to be done, and we thank them for that. We have also, independently of working with the congressional delegation to try and actually get Congress to override the EPA, we filed suit in federal court, and it would seem as though our suit is very well grounded on a plain reading of the words of the Clean Air Act. If you just simply follow the scheme set forth in the Clean Air Act, it would require that hazardous air pollutants, and mercury is specifically listed in the short list of the worst hazardous air pollutants, that they need to be controlled with the application of maximum achievable control technology. And using that standard, you end up talking about a 90% control figure, because that's what's attainable today. Instead, the EPA is delisting the utility industry from the list of industries that are required to meet that standard. They're saying that the utility industry doesn't have to meet the standard, even if other industries do, and that gives them the opportunity to set a weaker standard and allow them to trade pollution rights so that they can actually buy and sell the rights to pollute. That sometimes that market incentive approach could work with certain pollutants. It makes a lot less sense when there is no buffering capacity in the environment, when the pollutant is a potent neurotoxin, and when you end up with serious hot spots downwind of every single plant that continues to put the mercury out.
So you'll continue to pose these legal challenges, and we're running close to being out of time here. Do you have any idea when you'll be hearing back on the next step, whether your challenge is going to carry any weight or whether you'll have to take it further?
Well, the federal courts can work in mysterious ways. It seems all parties involved, including the utility industry, would like a quick resolution to this so that they know and we know what the future holds. If we're going to get changes one way or another to how much mercury is emitted, we should do it sooner rather than later. Let's hope the courts hear that, but sometimes they work on a slow schedule.
Can people get more information from your website? Or
we do have information on this posted and on mercury hazard in general. That would be at nrcm.org, www.nrcm.org, or maineenvironment.org. Either one of those goes to the same site.
Okay, and is there a phone number for Natural Resources Council of Maine that people can call if they don't have Internet access?
Sure, that would be 207-622-3101.
Okay, and
my name is John Hink.
Great, and you'll keep us updated, John, on how this develops?
I would be pleased to do that, Amy.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you for your good show.
Thanks. That's John Hink from the Natural Resources Council of Maine. And next, we have an update on the situation in Washington County today. We have joining us by phone on one phone line, attorney Lynn Williams, who represents the Passamaquoddy tribe members who are fighting to protect their homeland. And on another line, we are joined by both Radioactive co-host Meredith DeFrancesco, who's in Washington County, along with former Passamaquoddy State Representative Donna Soctoma. The two of them having attended the press conference there this afternoon, and if listeners will be patient, Meredith and Madonna are going to be passing one phone back and forth so we can hear from both of them. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
And Meredith, can you start by giving us a little bit of an update of what happened earlier this afternoon?
Yes, certainly. Today, the company Quaddy Bay LLC, along with Pleasant Point Passamaquoddy attorney Craig Francis and Governor Melvin Francis, announced that the Bureau of Indian Affairs has not only waived the appraisal of the proposed liquefied natural gas operations on tribal land, but has approved the entire application for the project. The approval, they say, was issued at the end of May. They say they waited a month and a half to announce this approval because of the great significance of this project. Other tribal members and tribal council member Hilda Lewis, who have also been in communication with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, BIA, say that they do not believe the decision has taken place and have been in contact with officials in June who have said the process would take 6 months to consider. In fact, tribal council member Hilda Lewis said she had only heard the announcement today and had only been informed of the meeting earlier this week. No written documentation was provided at the press conference of the approval. Tribal attorney Craig Francis says he had met with the BIA in D.C. to assure them the project met several requirements, including that there was a fair market rental and that environmental and cultural impacts were taken into consideration. The archaeological survey, however, required by the Historic Preservation Act to assess cultural and archaeological impacts by projects on federal or tribal land, has not yet been completed. No environmental assessment has been made at this point. Quaddy Bay Project Manager Brian Smith said that this would be done during the FERC process, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, who would have ultimate approval of this project. the Bureau of Indian Affairs has a trust responsibility to the tribe. Without yet talking with BIA directly, details still remain unclear. We have with us today, as you mentioned, I'm sitting here with Passamaquoddy member Madonna Saktoma, former representative of the Passamaquoddies in the Maine State Legislature, as you said, and she's going to talk about a number of aspects about this issue, along with, as you mentioned, Lynn Williams. And I'd like to welcome Madonna Saktoma, who's going to also start by familiarizing a little bit of who, what the BIA role is, and a reaction to this project, and then we'll go into a little bit about what the Passamaquoddy Tribe at Indian Township feels on this issue, and what some of those are considerations are concerning water rights and the sharing of natural resources, and some other things. And as we said, if I have something to interject, we are sharing a phone, but Madonna. We'll be speaking right now. Madonna Saktoma.
Great. Thanks for joining us, Madonna. And also, hi, Madonna. And on the other line, we also have Lynn Williams, who will be, after Madonna gives her reaction to what happened today and also talks a little bit to the issues that Meredith just introduced, Lynn Williams is also going to tell us about a letter that she has written, just sent off today, to the Bureau of Indian Affairs outlining several significant concerns that they have with the project that they feel are just not being addressed at all. So a lot of issues, a lot of complicated issues to cover, but we'll try to take them one at a time. And Madonna, go ahead and start.
Okay. Hi, Lynn, first of all.
Hi, Madonna.
She's the attorney that was hired by the No LNG Group, and he's doing a very good job. I picked up the newspaper, and I read the article in the Bangor Daily that says, Bureau okays LNG deal. Bureau, meaning Bureau of Indian Affairs. Well, they don't approve LNG deals. FERC does. So there's a misconception about writing that kind of stuff in the newsletter to try to give the impression or a positive spin on the issue to make LNG here at Sibayik attractive and marketable for investors is what I'm thinking, because the Bureau certainly is not in a position to do that. The Bureau of Indian Affairs responsibility is the administration and management of 55.7 million acres of land held in trust by the United States for American Indians, Indian tribes, and Alaskan Natives. And inception in March 11, 1824, the Bureau of Indian Affairs has been a witness to and the principal player in the history of federal-tribal relationship.
So, I'm sorry, Madonna.
Go ahead.
Their role is normally, from what I understand, and either or both of you jump in, the Bureau of Indian Affairs would normally be trying to make sure that the tribe is getting a good deal. They're supposed to conduct different kinds of studies, like appraisals, unless the tribe asks them to waive it. Their role is to try to help determine whether or not the tribes are getting a good deal with something like this?
The BIA role is there to ensure that the native land is protected for native now and in the future. That is their primary role. And if the tribe decides to lease or sell land, then they come into play to make sure that we get the best possible deal. So I don't understand why some of the tribal council members, well, four of them from Pleasant Point and a tribal governor, try to bypass that step with BIA, because that is their primary interest, to make sure that we get the best deal under the right circumstances.
Right. Lynn, do you can you contribute anything to that? Do you want to add anything?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear both of you.
Okay. A few things that I included in the letter that I wrote on behalf of the tribal members who are opposing the project. The first really, really troubling thing is the lease. In the lease, the tribal council waives property taxes, real estate taxes. So essentially, Quaddy Bay will not have to pay any property taxes over the term of the lease, which could be up to 56 years. This is a lot of money, and this, in fact, could come to more money than even the lease fee. Yet they waived this from the get-go. Secondly, the lease talks about an exclusion zone, and it's in an alternative project configuration, and that's not specific. It's not mapped. It's not shown in the lease. It's not described in the lease. It's conceivable the exclusion zone could include houses and other facilities on the land. And it just is not described.
And to clarify for listeners, 2 points. One is that the exclusion zone is the area around these tanks that is excluded from any kind of use while the tanks or the facilities are there. There can be the moving exclusion zones.
That's
when
right.
The tanks
and
are moving
the ship
through.
Also has an exclusion zone.
Right.
So even if there's no tanks, for example, just briefly, in Boston Harbor where there's a facility, the exclusion zone about the around the ship is a moving zone 2 miles ahead of the ship and 1 mile on either side. So this takes in a lot of area in this very small, pristine vicinity.
And I want to say before you go any further, Lynn, another point that we haven't made yet today, I don't believe, is that this lease that the tribal council is looking at signing on to with the LNG, with Quaddy Bay LNG, is a lease that has been extremely secretive. What we're talking about this lease that really is seems to be quite unusual in the powers that it gives to the LNG facility and how very little power or economic consideration it gives the tribe. It is also one that the tribe hasn't approved as tribal members because they weren't all allowed to vote. They haven't seen it for the most part. It was issued to the seven-member tribal council about an hour before the meeting that they approved it, and then the LNG folks took it away from them again at the end of the meeting, and one member was able to get a hold of a copy of it, so you've been able to analyze it, but it's not something that everyone has looked at and decided that they agree with.
No, it's not. It's not. And it's a very inequitable lease. Termination of the lease is extremely inequitable. There's a huge fine if the tribe terminates the lease, plus they need the permission of the Secretary of the Interior. But if the company decides essentially that the plant is no longer economically viable, they can break the lease.
They also are able to just take more land and more space when they decide they need it, basically?
They are. There's a clause in the lease about relocation, and they essentially, if they say that they need some land as part of the project or the inclusion zone, they can, quote, relocate either people who are living on that land or facilities that are on that land, and they can even relocate them off the reservation.
Madonna's Soctoma, yes, please
can
comment.
Can I just interject something while this interview is going on? I'm in my home. And looking out the window, Split Rock is less than a quarter of a mile. It's less than a quarter of a mile. And I'm looking out of my kitchen window.
And that's where they plan to put the facility now, right?
Yes. And right next door to me is a school to the left of me. And to the right of me, a few feet up, is the health center.
So you may all be in the exclusion zone.
And just about less than another quarter, well, a few feet, few yards, is the elderly complex. I'm looking at Split Rock right now as I talk to you. And the process that was used was no process.
when they did the non-binding referendum and 193 people voted to entertain and explore an LNG site, that exclusivity agreement expired May 14, 2005. And a week or so later, the Smiths pushed for a lease agreement, which did not include the public. They did have no public process whatsoever. Ordinarily, the tribe, the four council members and the governor, have not abide by their own tribal governing rules by having a public process and another vote saying and naming the area of the proposed LNG at Split Rock. The other thing is the voters do not all reside here at Zibayik. The Passamaquoddy people who live within a 50-mile radius of Pleasant Point have been allowed for health services and voting purposes. But we have never had anything to this magnitude for land use, land lease, and there's nothing in place on how to do it. So they feel it's free reign.
Madonna, we are just about out of time, and so I want you to just give any last comment about what you think is going on here or what you think needs to happen.
Well, what needs to happen is the people process of the residents of Zibayik and exclude any people who do not live on this reservation. We can go in the town of Perry and tell them how to live. Anybody else shouldn't be able to come to Zibayik and tell us how to live. And we're under a joint tribal council for our natural resources. That includes Indian Township and Pleasant Point under the Joint Tribal Council under the 1980 Settlement Act. The water rights and the land belong to every Passamaquoddy person living at Indian Township and Pleasant Point. And there was a resolution by the governing body at Indian Township, Governor Newell,
and council members
said they will not support LNG.
Okay.
Because they have water rights here.
Right. And this, like we mentioned earlier, is a very complicated issue, which is why we continue to cover this as much as possible. And sorry we didn't get to everything we wanted to today, but we are out of time. We thank you for joining us. That's Madonna Sartoma and Lynn Williams. And we will definitely be hearing more from both of them again and on another program. And as we end today, we just have one last announcement. This evening is the 21st anniversary of the death of Charlie Howard, a young gay man who was attacked by a group of teenagers and thrown into the Kanduskeg stream in downtown Bangor. As the teenagers taunted him and called him names, Charlie suffered an asthma attack as he struggled to get out of the stream. And by the time his friend who had escaped was able to come back with help, Charlie Howard had drowned. He is remembered by those who knew him as a man who had the courage to be himself openly, some say flamboyantly gay, in the city of Bangor in the 1980s. He was 23 years old when he died. There will be a memorial service for Charlie Howard tonight at the Universalist Unitarian Church on Park Street in Bangor at 6:30, to be followed at approximately 7:15 by a walk to the site of his death at the bridge over the Kanduskeg in the block behind the Grasshopper Shop. To make contributions to a scholarship fund being set up in Charlie Howard's name, contact Dan Williams at 942-9319. And you've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco. Joel Mann engineered. Andy Buckley does web and technical support. Our website is radioactivenews.org. Our email address is radioactive@mainindymedia.org. Thanks for listening and acting, and please join us again next Thursday at 4 for Radioactive.